From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Larry Tye returns this week. The author of a biography of baseball great Satchel Paige, Larry Tye's latest book is a biography of the Man of Steel, Superman, who came to Earth with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. Now in paperback, ebook, and audiobook, the book is Superman, the high-flying history of America's most enduring hero. Larry Tye, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Great to be on with you again.
Since we last spoke, Superman and Wonder Woman have gotten it on.
They have. There are perpetual changes in Superman over the last 75 years and perpetual return to old themes. And Superman has had more marriages and more affairs with more different women, including superheroes, and now it's Wonder Woman.
Larry Tye, you've written books about, you wrote a great book about the Pullman Porters, and you wrote that wonderful book about Satchel Paige, the great ball player. What do you think is the unifying theme of your work? What brings you to Superman?
So every book that I write, every biography I think anybody writes, is a lens into some bigger issue. And the issue with Satchel Paige was his life was a perfect mirror of the era of Jim Crow. So when I sold the book to Random House, the first line of my proposal was, this is a biography of two American icons, Satchel Paige and Jim Crow. With Superman, I think understanding a guy who I think of as our longest-lasting American hero of the last century, he's lasted three-quarters of that last century as he's turning 75 now, gives us a lens into America and why we embrace the heroes that we do. And I tried to write this book in a way that partly was about the fun story of Superman and his long history, but it was also a look into what we embrace in every medium that was out there. Superman conquered and the medium of comic books and comic strips. He went on radio and he had the most popular radio show in America. He went on television and kids like me grew up with George Reeves as our Superman. He tells us at every point in the last 75 years what it is that we need in a hero, and he gives it to us. And I think it's a wonderful way not just to understand him, but to understand us.
Well, you know, there's some things about Superman that are puzzling in terms of his popularity. For instance, if nothing can happen to Superman except for the occasional kryptonite, why is Superman so interesting? That is, if nothing can happen to him, then why do we bother watching? Because, you know, he's always going to prevail because he's Superman, even in the worst case scenario when he turns the Earth back in the movie so that he goes back in time to before anything bad happens. You know, I was hoping he'd go back in time to before I paid my money to go into the picture.
I think that it's for the same reason that we watch The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, and he's lasted even longer than Superman, and yet we know how every one of those Sherlock Holmes mysteries is going to come out. He's going to prevail. He's going to find the bad guy. And I think that in a way that's reassuring. In the same way that Superman, he's not the dark hero that Batman is. He's not the fraught hero that Spider-Man is. He's a Dudley do-right character. And yet, I think in a world as complicated and as dark and fraught as ours is, there's something wonderful about knowing that Superman instinctively knows the difference between right and wrong, and there's something wonderfully reassuring knowing in the end, no matter how vile his enemies, and some of them have been very funny, like the prankster and like Mr. Mixelpicklet, some of them are evil characters with dark histories, like the ultra-humanite who was his first enemy, and like his most famous enemy, who is Lex Luthor, that there's still something wonderful in watching him take on these enemies, watching him be tempted and yet always end up on the side of right. And the evidence isn't my saying it. The evidence is that 75 years into it, he's still the king of the hill of superheroes.
Well, there's a new Superman movie coming this summer, and as you pointed out, Superman is the Dudley Do-Right of superheroes. But recent incarnations of superheroes have been incredibly dark. Do you think audiences will still respond to the Big Blue?
Every era, we thought that they wouldn't. We thought that he was dated. In fact, in the 1990s, the DC Comics gurus were so convinced that Superman might be passé that they took a chance and killed him off. And there were editorials in the New York Times and every other newspaper around the world saying, "What have you done to our Superman?" Every time we're ready to discard him and we think he is dated, his creators do something to bring him a bit more alive and a bit more contemporary. They just had him, as you know, not just hook up with Wonder Woman, but quit the Daily Planet and become a blogger. They tease at the edges to make him seem more timely, and yet at his core, he is the same guy that Jerry and Joe gave us in 1938. And I say that's a good thing, that in fact today has a lot in common, our world around us, with what the situation was in 1938 when Superman came to life. We were then in the Great Depression. We're now in the never-ending recession. We were then on the eve of World War II. We're now in the never-ending war against terrorism. And I think that the sense of having this character out there who is sort of rock solid, we'll see whether I'm proven right with the Man of Steel movie, but I think Warner Brothers won't consider this summer's movie a success unless it earns north of $1 billion, and I think it will.
Now, you just touched on another one of those little things that has always made Superman a difficult character. If he's so superpowered, why doesn't he just make everything okay? You know, he never, in World War II, for instance, he never went and grabbed Hitler and pulled his head off, which he could have.
He could have, and that was a brilliant decision by the DC Comics handlers of Superman back then, that while lots of superheroes were going off and fighting the war, they developed this wonderful storyline where Clark Kent went in to take his induction exam, and he was reading the eye chart, only instead of the eye chart right in front of him, he was reading one three examining rooms in, and with his X-ray vision, and he failed his eye test. And I think the reason they did that was because they understood if Superman actually went to war, people would say, "Why isn't the war over in 5 minutes?" And that would diminish the efforts of our troops who were fighting and often dying overseas. And so instead they kept him on the home front. He, in the comic books, was protecting us against saboteurs, and in the real world, they were using Superman for every war bonds drive. He was the most successful recruiter for people to sign up and buy war bonds. He would teach illiterate troops how to read. By what better way could you learn how to read than have words that were two syllables long with pictures illustrating just what was going on? And tens of thousands of American soldiers learned how to read with Superman. Ration kit that went off overseas. There was a Hershey chocolate bar. There was very smartly a pack of cigarettes to addict our troops to cigarettes when they came back. And there was a comic book, and it was almost always a Superman comic book, to remind them of not just truth and justice, but of the American way that they were out there fighting for.
The last time we spoke, Larry Tye, you were telling us about the lawsuit that the heirs of Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster were still litigating. What's the status now?
The status was that a couple months ago there was a decision by a panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals, and what they said was the district court judge had said, "We're going to give the heirs of Superman's creators, these two kids who sold Superman in 1938 for the grand total of $130, we're going to give them parts of his costume and parts of his story. The other parts are left to Warner Brothers, and we're going to tear him apart." And what my book argued was we needed a judge with the wisdom of Solomon to realize that if we divided up the various things that constituted Superman, we'd be tearing the baby in half and there'd be nothing worth preserving. Well, thankfully, this appeals court panel had the wisdom of Solomon. It said the settlement that the heirs almost reached about 6 years ago was in fact binding, which means that the heirs would become rich and that Warner Brothers will own Superman, and most importantly for Superman fans, unless some higher court overturns this, we will finally have this thing settled and we'll be able to go on assuring that this isn't the last Superman movie we ever see this summer.
You haven't seen the film yet, have you?
I have not. I've just heard from insider friends that it really is equal to the kinds of films that they were producing in the early days of the Christopher Reeve movies. They think that this is the one that's really going to hit big.
Of course, they did think that about the last one.
they did indeed, but they hopefully learned the lesson from the last one. The last one earned $600 or $700 million around the world, but that was considered a failure. And the guy who played Superman, Brandon Routh, has never come back again for him. And they hope, uncharacteristically, counterintuitively, they hope that the British guy, Henry Cavill, who they've got to play Superman, will take this all-American hero and will make him global.
Now, you mentioned our Superman, George Reeves, and he was always the Superman of my generation, too. When you were doing your research in your book, what did you learn about his death?
So I spent a long time with two people. One was the chief investigator of the L.A. County Coroner's Office, and they are the people who investigated his death. And the other was with one of the top forensic experts here in Boston, and we pieced together all the evidence. And I'm convinced that he died of three things. One was drinking too much. A second was a deadly mixture of the drinking he was doing with the pain pills he was taking for a car accident that he had had. And the third was depression. He was sufficiently depressed by the fact that he had to wear a girdle, that he had to dye his hair with food coloring, and that he was stereotyped as Superman forever. You mix those things, depression, alcohol, and drugs, and I think he actually did take a gun, put it to his head, and kill himself.
Even though so many of the people involved feel that that couldn't possibly be true. I mean, they were sitting with him 5 minutes before or something like
yes.
that.
Yes, even though that's true, and even though as a kid who read it in the newspaper, I was convinced that even if he wanted to, that Superman couldn't kill himself. I thought all the adults were really dumb, and they didn't understand that he was the Man of Steel, and a bullet wouldn't hurt him. Even though all of those things, I'm convinced as much as it would be a whole lot more dramatic and sell a lot more books if I could tell you that somebody had killed him, I spent more time with more of the people who were convinced that he was murdered, and their evidence just didn't convince me.
Let's get back to the $130 check and Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster for a minute. Do you think that there was, I don't know, the motive other than greed, you know, I guess normal everyday greed, but did national periodical publications know they were cheating those two guys?
Well, I think they actually thought, as part of this lawsuit, one of the only good things that comes out of a lawsuit is lots of papers that have never seen a public airing before, including Jerry Siegel's unpublished memoir and all the documents by the people at National Periodical, which became DC. And I'm convinced that they think they did right by Jerry and Joe. Yes, they only paid them $130, but on the other hand, they made them famous. They gave them salaries that in today's terms would be hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And they took them, they'd spent 5 years, Jerry and Joe had, trying to sell their story. And I think they would have given somebody some money if they were willing to publish it. So they didn't have to take the $130, and they didn't have to take all the fame and wealth that came from working for DC, and they realized they had a great deal, generally 9 out of 10 years, and every 10th year or so, like magic, they would get angry again, and particularly Jerry would, and they would sue again. DC would win the lawsuit. Jerry would say, I promise I'll never sue you again. They'd rehire him, and that would work for another 9 years.
Well, Larry Tye, in your book, Superman, the High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero, you do paint a picture of Siegel and Shuster as being guys who kind of squandered their nest egg that they got out of Superman.
They did. They squandered it in two ways. One was spending a lot more money than they were saving, so that when they ended up not working for a while, they had a tough time. And the other is squandering it in the sense of they gave up the rights totally of their own free will. And I think they squandered it in getting angry and letting anger dictate so much of what they did, to the point where Jerry's daughter says that essentially on his deathbed, he got his widow and his daughter to promise that they would continue this lawsuit. And it was just something, instead of relishing the fact that he was Jerry Siegel, the creator of Superman. He was Jerry Siegel, the guy who got ripped off by DC Comics, and that I don't think should have been his defining legacy.
He was so full of regret, or that he...
Full of partly regret, partly anger, and the pride that he felt in being the creator of Superman, I think, got overwhelmed by some of those negative feelings. And when we all get old and we have less going on, anger can sometimes, and resentment can sometimes take over, and I think it did too much for him. This was a guy who gave the world its most inspired hero, you know, of a century, and it's just the... And he ought to have been a guy who died happy.
Well, Larry Tye, your book about Superman tells us so many aspects of his life, as you say, not just about the life story, the fictional life story of the Man of Steel, but of his history. And he appeared in so many media, including radio and television and movies. But also, you know, we think of it as a comic book, but there was also a comic strip. Was that a successful strip?
It was a very successful strip. His comic book really launched the idea of original comics starting out in the comic books rather than just being a reprint of things that had already run in the strip. And he reversed the normal formula, starting out in the book and then moving to the strip. But the strip was in initially dozens and ended up in about 1,000 newspapers across America. And that brought in a lot of money, and it brought a whole lot more fame, so that it wasn't just whatever you might think about who reads the comic strips and newspapers. It's a heck of a lot of adults. And I think the kids grew up reading him in the comic books, adults grew up reading him in the comic strips, and today when I do book talks, I'm as likely to get a 90-year-old as I am to get a 10-year-old. And it's really wonderful the way Superman, over all these years, bringing in all these audiences, has really united the country with a hero that everybody can share.
How did the strip differ? You say the strip had more adult readers. Did it differ in content than the comic book? Did it have different characters? Did it have different themes?
It had different stories and the same characters. Every medium did a certain amount of pioneering of the story, so that Superman flew for the first time on the radio, and then he came into the comic book flying, and he... various things. He started out with just truth and justice, and it was only during World War II when DC Comics hired a child psychologist to coin a phrase that would suggest why we were overseas fighting that we came up with the American way. So the short answer is the comic strips were part of the comic books, and yet they did a certain amount of original work there as well.
How did Superman fare during the 1950s comic book scandals and Dr. Wertheim's Seduction of the Innocent, the book that condemned all comic books as being the source of juvenile delinquency in America?
Well, on the one hand, he was attacked by Wertheim as being essentially a sociopath, and on the other hand, he outlived Wertheim literally and figuratively. He was one of the few characters who was strong enough to survive Wertheim's attacks. He never went out of publication. A bit toning down, Lois's breasts became a bit less exaggerated, and there was a little less sense of any open amorousness, but there wasn't a whole lot of that in the first place, and I think that he was big enough that he could take on and beat even Wertheim.
Well, the Superman family, which you're kind of touching on here when you mention Lois, you know, there's Jimmy Olsen and Lois Lane, and they all had their own books for a while, and they all had their different kind of appeal. I think the Lois Lane comic was kind of a girl's version of the Superman story.
It's true. They all had their own audiences, which helped pull in the audience to Superman. I'm about to go out to California and do a talk with a guy named Jack Larson.
Oh, yeah.
Who was the original TV Jimmy Olsen. And this guy couldn't, when he was a teenager playing Jimmy Olsen, he couldn't go out in public in New York without crowds of kids gathering around, that it was Jimmy Olsen that the teenagers related to. It was, you know, Lois Lane. I spent some time last summer with a woman named Noelle Neal, who was, for all but 1 year of that TV show, she was Lois Lane. And she spent a good part of her adult life talking on college campuses and having young women come up and say that she was their professional inspiration, not just journalists, but she was one of the few really strong professional role models that women had in that era. And everybody, every woman who ever read her noticed that she beat Clark Kent in all the stories, and she was a real inspiration to them. So it's really fun to see the way each of these people drew in an audience, even the grandfatherly Perry White, Superman's editor. He was gruff, but he was somebody that a lot of grandparents could relate to.
Oh, and the actor who played him, now I suddenly can't remember his name, but the actor who played him in the television series, who we'd seen in a lot of Warner Brothers, he was a stock player at Warner Brothers and is in almost all of his Humphrey Bogart movies and so on. All of the actors in the Superman series were kind of sturdy character actors that we'd seen in films. And there's kind of a film noir feel, especially in the early seasons of that Superman TV show.
There was also, when I went back and watched these as an adult, I realized that George Reeve was an incredibly successful Superman in spite of his lack of acting skill. The difference between Superman and Clark Kent was putting on or taking off his glasses. The voice didn't change, the demeanor didn't change in the way that it did later on very dramatically when Chris Reeve played Superman. We never even asked. I love going back and watching these shows where the gangsters would fire all these bullets at Superman and they'd bounce off of him, and then the frustrated crook would throw the gun, and after having the bullets bounce off, he'd duck when the gun was thrown at him. And we wanted to believe so much that whether his flying looked fake or whether he was ducking at guns being thrown at him when he didn't duck at bullets, it was just something that his viewers were part of the deal, and they bought into him. And it was just really wonderful to see that.
I liked how the series would come up with new superpowers as needed. I remember the episode where he was able to not smash through a wall, but he passed through a wall by, I don't know, putting his hands up on the wall and concentrating on it.
It was great. Over the years, and in every medium that he was in, his powers would come and go as whoever was writing that episode decided to give him more or less power. And it was really wonderful because it wasn't just that he gained new powers, but when they felt he was becoming too powerful, they'd either invent something like kryptonite or they'd have some dastardly villain take away certain powers. And so over the years, Superman powered up and powered down. He got married, he got unmarried, he was killed, he came back to life. It was brilliant because it was fantasy and you could create and take away anything that you were building into the storyline.
You mentioned the death of Superman that happened in the 1990s when Doomsday beat him to death. Do you think that in your interviews, that the writers, publishers of that particular storyline ever intended to actually kill Superman? Didn't they plan to bring him back by the end of their story?
They always planned to bring him back, and they never even planned the death storyline. It was only because they were ready to have him get married to Lois. And the TV show, Lois and Clark, wasn't quite ready, and they decided he should get married first on TV and then in the comic books, or at the same time they really wanted to do it. So these were a bunch of writers who were sitting around looking for a storyline. Somebody yelled at the back of the room, "Let's kill him." And the same guy had been yelling that for years, and nobody paid any attention. And suddenly they were desperate for a story. They killed him, and the only people who were really worried about whether or not they would bring him back were, ironically, the brass at Warner Brothers and at Time Warner, who called in a frenzy saying, you know, how are you taking our billion-dollar hero and killing him? And they had to explain at DC Comics to them that that we can take him away and bring him back. And the biggest selling comic book with all the reprints of it in the history of the world was The Death of Superman.
Even though all of us comic book readers knew that he wasn't really dead, because nobody's ever dead in the comic books.
Well, we knew two things. One is we knew he wasn't really dead, and the other thing is, if we stopped to think about it, everybody was buying these issues thinking it'd be worth a fortune, and it would have been worth a fortune if 6 million people didn't buy it.
Yeah, that's right. A collector's item.
Exactly.
I'm sure a lot of people who bought those never read them, and they still are in the black plastic bag that they came in.
They are indeed. Hey, we've got to keep it right because we're going to sell it for $1 million.
If only they had Action Number One, they actually could sell it for $1 million.
It's funny that you should say that because I got an email, and I don't know how legitimate it was, from somebody asking me today for advice saying they had a really vintage copy of Action Number One and what should they do with it.
Tell them they should send it to me as a gift.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's it. That's it. So they can put all of our kids through college.
I just want it. I'll just put it up on the wall with some thumbtacks.
Exactly.
Well, Larry Tye, the book is called Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero, and it's an enduring book because now it's in paperback. Congratulations.
Thank you, and it's been wonderful to talk to you again.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week on From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page, fromthebookshelf.com, or find us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Larry Tye. His latest book, Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero, is now out in paperback. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody.